Welcome to Revealing Men, conversations that pull back the curtain, revealing the inner lives of men. I'm Randy Flood, psychotherapist and director of the Men's Resource Center of West Michigan.
For those of you who listen frequently and sequentially, you may have wondered what happened to our monthly rhythm. Well, the truth is, summer happened. Time off, slower pace of work, more space to breathe, more time outside, less time inside. But now we are back this fall with our regularly monthly publishing schedule, and I think you'll enjoy some of the interviews we got coming up this fall and winter. I look forward to it as well. But today, though, it's just me, and I want to take on something that I think has been weighing on us all. I'm going to speak to this, and anytime I do podcasts, I always want them to have shelf life. So you might hear some reference to current events, but basically what I'm saying is an age-old problem. It's not new. Yeah, we can say that we're living in volatile times, but this isn't the first time. Think back just in my life. I was born in 1963. That's the year John F. Kennedy was shot. And then eventually his brother Robert was assassinated. Then Martin Luther King was gunned down. Malcolm X was murdered. That decade was marked by turbulence, anger, political violence that felt similar to this situation where things were unraveling in our nation. Today, we're again faced with political violence and uncertainty. And just in the past few months alone, we've seen Charlie Kirk gunned down, the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. We saw Minnesota leaders, the speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark, were murdered in their home. That same day, State Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette were shot. And a few years back, some of you may remember Paul Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi, the former Speaker of the House. Her husband, Paul, was attacked in their San Francisco home by a man armed with zip ties and a hit list that included other ideas to murder Governor Gavin Newsom from California, Hunter Biden, and even Tom Hanks. And again, we have people with headlines that scare us, that make us wonder what is happening. What is happening? And we got the left speaking, we got the right speaking, we got the centrist speaking. Everybody's sharing their thoughts about what is currently going on. But in my opinion, we often miss a point that doesn't get discussed. Every time there's violence that erupts, people scramble to try to explain what's going on. And you take Charlie Kirk's killing. Why? We don't yet know whether the shooter was a radicalized leftist. There's theories going both ways. But we do know this. He believed that eliminating Charlie's voice and influence was, in his worldview, was necessary to get rid of some enemy, some evil voice or whatnot. And so that's what this killer did. And I think what followed this unfortunate killing was equally disturbing. While some agreed it was wrong, some condoned the killing. And now others are calling for retribution for the killing. And I just think violence begets violence. Supporting hate, even against those we disagree with, sows the seeds for more hate. It's ironic that Charlie Kirk really was a big believer in free speech and, you know, being able to openly debate competing ideologies in a place where there wasn't violence. And then he was killed by violence. And then those who are supporting him in his death are speaking about retribution and speaking about minimizing free speech. And we get comedians that are being canceled now because of free speech being now policed. So it's just sad that his legacy is being betrayed by people now trying to suppress free speech. Let's look at the Pelosi attack. That wasn't just a break-in. It was an organized plan with multiple targets that this person never got to. And again, it was targeted toward more progressive folk rather than someone like Charlie Kirk, who was more on the conservative side. So how do we make sense of these acts? Analysts often reach for categories. We like to have pure ideological categories. Sometimes there's conspiracies. There's, you know, talk about mental illness, despair. There's this idea that it's a salad bar theory, that young men stitching together bits of grievances from all over the cultural landscape. Others call some of these shooters annihilists, men who in a blaze of destruction hope to be remembered as the one who took down the evil system or evil person. But I think to simplify, I think of like four overlapping categories. I think of the annihilist, who believe the system or a person is so corrupt that destruction is their heroic act. And these can be the school shooters as well. They go down in some kind of blaze of glory because they have no meaning and purpose in their own life. And then they end up just taking out others with a sense of power. And the most egregious form of power is taking another person's life. And then we said the salad bar shooters, who mix and match grievances and conspiracies until they justify their violence. And then the third category is the despair-driven, where men without any clear ideology, but only loneliness and hopelessness and wanting to matter for one destructive moment. And then the fourth category would be the identity warriors. And this comes from the social identity theory, and that is, you know, shooters who define themselves by their in-group and target out-groups with calculated hostility. And that's where you often see political violence in that fourth category. But most shooters fall into one or more of these categories, and behind them all is one glaring truth that you don't hear talked about, which myself and other psychologists and social scientists like Jackson Katz and folks like that are speaking to this truth. And that is about 98-99% of perpetrators are men. Let me say that again, just in case we don't realize that. 98% of perpetrators are men, not women, not grandmothers, not teenage girls, men. And mostly young men. In the U.S., largely young white men. Yes, there are inner city shootings involving young black men. There are immigrant men involved in violence. There are older men who commit killings. But when we look at political violence, mass shootings, ideological attacks, the overwhelming profile is male and often white and often young. And here's the hard truth. If nihilistic young women were storming schools with AR-15s, we would be having a national conversation about gender, guaranteed. If radicalized anti-woke conservative women were targeting politicians, we would be having a national conversation about gender, guaranteed. If radicalized anti-MAGA liberal women were assassinating their political enemies, we would be having a national conversation about gender. But because it's men, because it's baked into our cultural expectations, we normalize it. And we don't even say the word. Noticed at the beginning of the podcast, I was even saying shooters, and you probably didn't think anything of it. You didn't correct me. Maybe some of you did, but didn't say, why aren't you saying young men or men? Why aren't you making it explicitly gender? Why aren't you naming it? I am now, but I didn't before because I wanted to make a point. So why men? Dr. Candace Batten, she's a criminologist at the University of Nebraska. She explains it this way, quote, males are more likely than females to develop negative attributions of blame that are external in nature. The cause of my problems is someone else or some force outside of me. That's the difference. Instead of sitting with fear, shame, failure, insecurity, all these confusing, vexing emotions in our interior lives, Many men are groomed by culture to ignore what's going on in the interior and to externalize, to look outward and say, it's her fault. It's their fault. They did this to me. This is the target. This is the problem. And I am going to be an agent to externalize those feelings I can't express onto my targets. That's what Dr. Batten is trying to say in her quote. And once that projection takes hold, it feeds into sustained resentment and carefully justified hostility. The next step is often meticulous preparation, identifying the targets, securing the weapons, studying entry points, even compiling lists or manifestos. This is the deliberate part. It is planned and it is methodical. It's not impulsive. It might be stoked by mercurial emotions inside the young man, but that's often emotions he or she, he has been trained to turn away from and not pay attention to, because emotions make you weak. And that's the business that women pay attention to. It's not what men spend time doing. They look at the external world and look at things outside them that Dr. Batten's saying that's explaining their malaise and explaining their discomfort and looking for something to do with it to make those feelings go away. Because once you overpower the target, then you delude yourself into thinking you're going to be able to vaporize or take out the feeling that's bothering you. Imagine a different way, if we could have a different way. And this is what we do at the Men's Resource Center. It's not that we're dealing with shooters necessarily. Obviously, I've never had a client in the 30-plus years commit any kind of murder, commit acts of violence, but not like domestic violence and such, and bar fights, but not actual murder. But we work to help men ask important questions. Men who might be flooded with rage or flooded with despair, lack of meaning and purpose. And we teach them to pause and ask, what if these shooters could pause and ask, what am I really afraid of here? What kind of shame am I experiencing? Or what kind of grief? Or where's my loneliness play into this malaise I'm feeling or these thoughts I'm having? What do I need that I don't yet have words for? Or who can I talk to right now? I'm having some really, really tough thoughts and feelings, and some thoughts that are really scaring me that could get me in trouble in prison or a death penalty or in jail or something. But who can I talk to about this? Who's safe in my life where I could share these feelings and be vulnerable and not be shut down or shamed or ridiculed for having these feelings? What if I called a friend, a brother, a counselor, a minister, or a group, my AA group? Can I talk to them? Can I talk to my sponsor and just say I'm struggling? Or what if I took these feelings and thoughts and turned them into something positive and, you know, like organizing others who might experience similar feelings of despair instead of turning my despair into destruction, destruction of others, and eventually destruction of myself? That's what we call emotional intelligence or relational courage. It's that ability to experience rage and despair, but choose to process it, share it, and channel it into constructive, life-giving action. And here's another important truth. Supporting young men through their confusion, loneliness, and despair does not mean abandoning women. It's not zero sum. We don't have to choose between helping men and helping women. We can do both, and we must do both. It's one of the frustrating things I experience in sometimes in my work, being confronted with that zero-sum thinking. I remember trying to get funding for our All Together Boys program, going into the middle schools, trying to talk to young men about what it means to be a man in the 21st century and helping them understand that remaining connected to others is important and learning about emotional intelligence. And we couldn't get funding often because it was kind of seen as, why do young men need help? We've had patriarchy for centuries, and it's our funding and resources need to go to women. Hence, Girls Inc. And I'm saying that Girls Inc. and other resources for women need to continue. We do not need to take from those resources, but add to it and see that we can do both and support young men as well. Because where are young men getting support? And who's profiting from them reaching out? You hear about the manosphere, the influential podcasters, YouTubers, online mentors. They tell young men all about masculinity, right? Some of them are saying real men dominate. Real men don't get canceled. Real men take back what's rightfully theirs. It's more of a grievance culture. And it's helping young men feel that they're entitled to something that's been taken away from them. And so it's not a surprise when you look at some of the surveys of young men today is that they are grasping to more traditional views of manhood because it's giving them some kind of structure and answer to their grievances and gives them at least a roadmap to taking back what they feel is entitled to them rather than some blurry, confusing roadmap of sharing power with others and building others up and some other more diverse form of masculinity that we'll talk about in a little bit here. But if you layer on top of that sense that woke culture is actually mocking these men, canceling them, blaming them for being male, just for being white, the message they hear is that you're toxic and you're the problem. And into that wound, the influencers pour rhetoric that legitimizes those grievances and entitlements. And then you add the algorithms designed to maximize outrage, content that rewards conflict, fear, and moral uncertainty, and you've got a feedback loop big time. Men searching for answers, being fed content that frames life as a zero-sum battle. Us against them, women against men against women, women against men, box against whites. It's all this divisiveness because that's what feeds the clicks. So social media, they promise connection when it was first founded and introduced to us, but it frequently delivers more isolation, comparison, and amplification of grievance and envy. So we are conditioning young men to live in constant vigilance and hostility. Some take that conditioned grievance into careful plans for harm, and others take it into political or social action that erodes trust and safety. And let's be clear, this is not partisan. This is not a partisan issue. The young man who killed Charlie Kirk may not fit neatly into an ideological box, but he clearly believed eliminating Charlie's voice would make the world better. At the same time, others on the right have targeted so-called woke figures, cancel culture voices, immigrants, women, seeing them as disruptors of social norms. Different targets, same playbook. Young men in despair, weaponized by grievance. And when violent rhetoric is condoned or celebrated on any side, it normalizes harm and invites further harm. That normalization, I think, is dangerous. And zoom out here, while we're fighting each other, who benefits? One of the beneficiaries are the oligarchs, the billionaires, the power holders who want us distracted. You remember what Lyndon B. Johnson once said? He said, if you can convince the lowest white man he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice you're picking his pocket. That's still true. If you keep men occupied with scapegoats, women, immigrants, racial minorities, political opponents, you keep them from examining policies, redistricting, what otherwise called as gerrymandering, corporate power, corporate welfare, rather than just looking at the welfare of handing out to people who aren't working, and deals crafted behind closed doors that concentrate wealth and influence. We don't see that stuff. We're paying attention to all this other stuff that's distracting us. And here's a hard and necessary point. I think some people pursue dominance and conquest through violence, and some pursue it through institutional power. Like I said, gerrymandering, legislation that rigs the rules, economic policies that hollow out communities, backroom deals that protect wealth, both forms are expression of narrow masculinity that prizes power over people. Both do real damage. And because their dramatic criminal acts are quick and graphic, gunfire or assassination attempts, they dominate headlines and moral outrage. Meanwhile, other forms of harm, the slow legal bureaucratic, quietly reshape people's lives, entrench inequalities, and erode democratic agency. We notice the spectacle and often miss the systems that perpetuate it. So now what? What do we do with all this despair and violence? Both the violent acts and the structural harms that enable them. In conclusion, I would just say we got to do a few things here. How about we start by redefining strength, what masculine strength looks like. And again, when I say masculine strength, that doesn't mean that women can't demonstrate strength, that claiming masculine energy, it's not bound to a certain sex just as much as men can claim nurturance and take care of their little babies in very soft and empathic ways. So call it feminine energy, masculine energy, but don't link it directly to the sexes, because we are humans and we can embrace both energies or be taught to cultivate both energies. So redefining strength, Martin Luther King Jr., he said, power at its best is love, implementing the demands of justice. And justice at its best is love, correcting everything that stands against love. So that's his definition of strength. So real strength is not crushing others, it's lifting them up. That takes more courage than domination ever will. What about revisioning masculinity? Masculinity is not the problem. Rigid, brittle, insecure masculinity is. We need a more evolved 21st century masculinity that I think is flexible. Can sometimes be tough, but other times tender. Masculinity that can protect when needed, but also can nurture, listen, and connect when needed. Men who can define themselves by service as well, not just dominance, will change outcomes, both interpersonal and political, with nonviolence. Three, what about building greater communities of connection? Loneliness kills. Men need communities where they can speak their despair, where vulnerability is not mocked but honored. And again, as you know, in the Men's Resource Center, we do men's therapy groups, and that is a place where I see remarkable levels of courage and vulnerability, where men share their hearts, and other men who in their life as construction workers, welders, farmers, trial attorneys, doctors, you name it, they can perform high levels of masculine energy and courage outside the office. But when they sit in circles in my office, they hold space for each other, and they don't mock each other for being vulnerable. They have a more flexible masculinity. So that means, you know, groups like that, mentorship programs, support groups, friendships that go deeper than sports scores and work complaints. Pulling back the curtain and seeing what's vulnerable in our lives, seeing what's really going on. And it means political organizing that is inclusive and economic policies that restores community and opportunities. And four, I would say we're challenging this us versus them divisiveness. I mean, I would like to see us, you know, one-issue voter. What about if we started, voting for people who will help us turn down the temperature? That gets them in the political door to have legitimacy. It's like, who's going to turn down the temperature a little bit? Things are heating up, and we just need to tone down the rhetoric, treat others how we want to be treated. The great scriptures say, love your enemies. I mean, we don't even talk about that discipline and that challenge anymore. It's all about trying to figure out how to tear your enemies apart and show how they're wrong and show how we can defeat them. Social identity theory does show us how easy it is to fall into in-group and out-group thinking. And the antidote to this is curiosity. to honor our identities without dehumanizing others. Disagreement? Sure. Charlie Kirk was great at debate. And yes, we need debates, but not dehumanization. And others criticize him because his debates got into dehumanizing other people as part of proving his point. But that's not the point of this podcast. The reality is that he promoted debate. And we need to challenge the systems, not just the people, and focus our energy on changing laws, not just wrecking lives. You know, it's just so much to do. And lastly, I just think we need to tell better stories. Every influencer, every media host, every one of us has a platform, even if it's just our dinner table or our Facebook wall. Will we sprinkle violent rhetoric like gasoline and wait for the spark, or will we water the ground and plant something life-giving? Can we model masculinity that builds, not tears down? Will we name both forms of harm, violent and institutional, and hold both accountable? Yes, we need to tell better stories. Friends, these are anxious times. Violence, both the dramatic criminal acts and the quieter structural harms, feels close. But the way forward is not to build bigger walls or trade blame boxes. It's to name the truth. A narrow, dominance-driven definition of masculinity, one that prizes conquests and power at the expense of others, is a root problem. Some people enact that definition with guns. Others enact it through policy, redistricting, and deals behind closed doors. But both wound our communities. If we can change what we mean by being a man, if we can build deeper connection, honest accountability, and courageous compassion, then we can protect our communities from both the sudden violence of a planning mind, a retribution mind, and the slow violence of institutional power that erodes communities. That's what I believe, and that's what we must work for. This is Revealing Men. Again, thanks for listening, and we look forward to more programming this fall with some really good interviews. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Revealing Men. If you're looking for more information about counseling, coaching, and consultative services, please visit the Men's Resource Center of West Michigan online at menscenter.org. Also, feel free to contact us on our website if you have questions about this segment, ideas for a topic, or would like to be a guest on the Revealing Men podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating so others can find us. Be well and have a great day.